Five.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nam, the show connecting your neighborhood with the world. It was dubbed the handshake that bruised the nation. Last month, Bill Gates greeted South Korea's president, Park Geun-hye, with one hand stuffed into his pocket, a traditional sign of disrespect in Korean culture. It was a faux pas that set off an etiquette firestorm, and just the latest example of the way seemingly innocuous interactions can quickly devolve into misunderstandings and mistaken impressions. International diplomats and business leaders have long known the hazards of ignoring other cultures' norms. Remember when Michelle Obama broke protocol and touched Queen Elizabeth's back, or when George H.W. Bush became ill at a state dinner in Japan? But today, businesses operating within our own borders are confronting similar issues, moving beyond standard do's and don'ts to help people understand what makes other cultures tick and, well, what makes our culture tick too. Our guests have spent their careers imparting the nuances of cultural competency to others. Howard Ross is back. He is a diversity consultant and principal of Cook Ross. He's author of the book Reinventing Diversity, Transforming Organizational Community to Strengthen People, Purpose, and Performance. Howard, good to see you.
Hi, Kojo.
Gary Weaver also joins us in studio. He's a professor at American University School of International Service. He's also executive director of the university's Intercultural Management Institute. Gary Weaver, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
800-433-8850 is the number to call for you to join the conversation. 800-433-8850. Howard, I opened the show by mentioning some of the more famous or, well, infamous examples of cross-cultural gaffes that we've seen in recent times. But most of us won't be meeting the Queen or holding bilateral talks anytime soon. So why is it important to be culturally competent?
Well, you know, we're dealing right now, Kojo, in a culture, you know, forget leaving the country. Even in this country right now, we have almost 12% of our residential population are people who were born outside of the United States, which is the highest percentage since the 19th century. And so even if we're in our offices, in our businesses here, we've got increasingly people who we're dealing with who were born outside of the country, whose parents were born outside of the country. I give an opening lecture every year to the freshman class at Johns Hopkins University. And this year when we gave that talk, there were about 1,400 students in the room. And I asked them to raise their hand if they were born outside of the United States or one of their two parents were born outside of the United States. And more than half of the students raised their hand. So this is the world we're dealing with. And I also want to insert from the beginning into our conversation an invitation that we look at culture in a broader sense than simply a race, ethnicity, or nation of origin, because there was a fascinating story in the Washington Post 2 weeks ago today, and I'm sure some of our listeners saw it. And what it said was that 75% that soldiers coming back from Afghanistan or Iraq are 75% more likely to die in fatal car accidents when they come back to this country, especially during the first 6 months, I believe it was. And what they went on to say was that the reason, and they suspect, is because the way of driving that they're taught in a war zone, keeping their seatbelts off so that they can leave a car quickly, driving through intersections quickly, you know, various other kinds of things, when they transfer those into this culture, a different culture, you know, the culture of war versus the culture of a peacetime city, ends up resulting in them dying. So I think there's a broad way we can talk about culture in this regard.
800-433-8850. What do you think? Do you think that we don't know as much as we should about other cultures, or do you think that's a stereotype of Americans that goes too far? 800-433-8850. Gary Weaver, as one of Washington's longtime global etiquette gurus, I'd like to ask you how the emphasis on this field has changed over the years, especially in institutions like the military and the State Department. Mm-hmm.
Well, what has changed is it used to be if you were going to be working overseas, let's say you're going to Mexico, often you would get some kind of a do's and don'ts list type of training. Do this, don't do that. They tell you the courtesies, put you on your plane, and assume you're going to function well overseas. But what we found out is very often that type of training simply perpetuated stereotypes. And today what we want to do is teach people how to analyze or interpret any situation they're likely to encounter based upon understanding the values and ways of thinking of people from another culture. So the goal of good cross-cultural training today in the military and the business world is to develop what I would call realistic cultural empathy. And that just means the ability to put yourself in someone else's psychological and cultural shoes, to understand the way they look at the world, the way they think, so you can usually figure out what is the proper thing to do. With Bill Gates putting his hand in his pocket, it's disrespectful to the president of Korea. But if you understood the value placed upon hierarchy, status, age, and so forth, you would simply know that if you're shaking hands with the president of the country, it's not like shaking hands with your buddy at a bar. It's a completely different social situation, and acknowledging status is so much more important in a country like Korea.
You know, Howard Ross, I don't think I've ever been to a country, or for that matter, to a state, where one of my traveling companions did not say, these people here don't know how to drive. I'd imagine that before you can train people to be sensitive to other cultures, you probably have to dig around and figure out what our biases are to begin with, right? Because mm-hmm. that's one that I just mentioned.
Well, that's true, but it just is a little anecdote about that. You know, when I was in India, it's now about 5-6 years ago, we got there the first couple of days, and my son at the time was 12. And we were traveling, and he literally the first 3 days had his hood pulled over his head most of the time because it was so terrifying to him. And you do have, you know, 5 lanes of traffic where there are 3 designated lanes, and in the middle of that, bicycles are coming through and toot-toots and a cow will walk across.
In fact, most people know how to drive.
Well, I was just going to say, but you know what we started to notice, Kojo, and I mean this seriously, over a period of time, we began to notice we saw virtually no accidents. And that was exactly what I was left with. These people really know how to drive. I mean, they have a sense of being who's around them and negotiating around them in extraordinary ways. But of course, we have a tendency to stereotype things that are different from us. And it's part of our brain's defense mechanism. You know, our amygdala is designed to pick up things that are threatening more than things that are welcoming. Because if we miss things that are welcoming, it's a nice surprise. If we miss things that are threatening, we could be dead. So foe is sort of our natural orientation when we see things that are different than us. And in order to know how to quickly resolve dealing with those things, we quickly put those into boxes. And that's why I agree with Gary that when we turn this into stereotypes, that is, you know, all people are like this. I mean, one great example we use, as you know, Coach, we do a lot of work in healthcare and have a tool called Culture Vision that we've designed, which is an online tool to have doctors and nurses have information available, everything from how do you communicate to people to what are the ethnopharmacological issues that they may deal with because of their genetic stream. And one example that I think I've talked about on the show before is that Vietnamese women, when they go into labor in American hospitals, tend to get dehydrated more than other groups. And the reason is not biological, it's cultural. That labor and delivery is considered a cold time, and during cold times, when it's a culture based on hot and cold theory. During cold times, women are told not to drink cold liquids or eat cold foods, but then the nurse brings them ice chips and ice water to drink, so they don't drink it. They get dehydrated. It extends their hospital stay, which has a financial cost. It impacts the mother's health. It delays lactation, which impacts mother and baby. But we say to people all the time, that doesn't mean that when you have a Vietnamese patient, you go over and say, here's warm water, because they may be acculturated differently. It is helpful to know to say, what temperature water would you like? And that's where an archetype of knowing that there's a pattern in a culture can be helpful to inform the questions that we ask and the kinds of things we're looking for. But turning it into an automatic response, as Gary was saying, becomes a stereotype, which can be problematic.
Indeed, if you go to our website, kojoshow.org, you can read about some of the interesting and often unknown cultural needs that doctors encounter when they treat parents from other countries. That's at our website, kojoshow.org. Gary, when you train our nation's diplomats, you said it's no longer mainly a matter of do's and don'ts. Is there a real interest in knowing what makes other cultures tick?
I think there is, and particularly in the military today, because it could save your life. I mean, if you understand the way other people perceive a situation, the way they think, the way they solve problems, then you can anticipate how they're going to respond to what you say and what you do. And that may be a vital survival skill. And in the military today, I think many people would say, if it saves my life and saves me from hurting somebody else, then it's worth knowing. I do a lot of work with law enforcement and the police officers that I've worked with who take this stuff very seriously are not the young rookie cops. I mean, these are the guys with a pistol on the ankle and one on the hip, and, you know, they want the cross-cultural stuff an hour between how to use a baton and how to use handcuffs, but, you know, let's get it over with and move on. The old-timers, when you start talking about this cross-cultural misunderstanding, they want to testify. They want to tell you about that Puerto Rican kid that they stopped, and he stood 10 inches from their face, and he's supposed to stand 18 inches, so he can't grab the sidearm. But all at once, this little incident where the Puerto Rican didn't know you're supposed to stand an arm's length, it degenerates into resisting arrest and so on and so forth. So the old-timers will testify as to how this stuff is very, very vital. It's very practical. And I think the same thing is true with many people in the military today. We've learned that this kind of knowledge and this kind of skill is vital to doing your job.
In case you're just joining us, that's the voice of Gary Weaver. He's a professor at American University School of International Service. He's also executive director of the university's Intercultural Management Institute. We're having a conversation about cultural competence. Also with us, of course, is Howard Ross, diversity consultant and principal of Cook Ross, author of Reinventing Diversity, Transforming Organizational Community to Strengthen People, Purpose, and Performance. And you, those of you who call 800-433-8850, have you ever encountered a cultural misunderstanding with your health care provider? Give us a call or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Is there a right way and a wrong way to train people in cultural competence? I ask because earlier this year, a cultural sensitivity training program at the USDA came under fire for its emphasis on what you might call extreme political correctness. A trainer had USDA employees banging on tables and chanting things like, "The Pilgrims were illegal aliens." Is there... Well, that didn't get a good response.
Well, I think that, I mean, Gary and I were talking about this before we came on, Kojo, and you know, as somebody who's done diversity work in organizations now for almost 30 years, one of the things that we suffer with is people who may be well-intentioned but who do things that are just inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges, of course, with diversity work is that historically, and this is really what my book's about, is why I call it Reinventing Diversity, is because historically we've looked at this subject through a good person, bad person paradigm. You know, and they're the good people who are like us, and we think everybody should be treated fairly and like, and then they're the bad people who do all that stuff that we're looking at. And there's no question that there are people out there who are hurtful and harmful intentionally, and they don't like certain groups of people, and they go out to hurt them. But our research shows pretty unequivocally that 90% of the things, or even more, that happen in organizations today are not by somebody who's out to get anybody. It's people who have blind spots. They don't realize that they're culturally insensitive. They don't realize that that person is operating differently, coming from a different cultural background or racial or ethnic or gender background or because of their life perspective or whatever else. And the challenge with those kinds of programs where we you know, take a position and try to ram it down people's throats using whatever clever techniques that we use is that even though we might be able to break down people and convince them to buy of the error of their ways and buy into that, that ultimately that doesn't have much stickiness, that ultimately when people leave, if they're made to feel guilty, they'll contract and they won't want to have anything to do with diversity ever again. And so what we choose to do is, of course, deal with those, you know, that 10% when they come up, and you know, we have to have a very firm line of what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. But the bigger conversation that really transforms human relationships is how do we begin to see that we each come from different perspectives, culture being one important lens of that. And if we can begin to understand that the world that we see is actually not the same world as the world of the person next to us, because those culture that culture provides lens. You know, you and I have talked about this as a black man in America versus somebody with white skin, and that we see different things, we react to different things without intention to harm a lot of times.
The minor stink, Gary, that emerged after videos of those USDA training sessions were released brings up what might be a common misperception about what cultural competency really is. You say that bad training is worse than no training.
Absolutely. If it perpetuates stereotypes, I think that's worse than no training. If it somehow gives people a self-confidence that they can handle these people who are culturally different and they really don't have that ability, then I think that's counterproductive. But also what we were just talking about, Howard was talking about, is that race relations training 20 years ago, and I think we all went through these seminars, where it often had to be highly emotional. You had to confess, I'm a racist. You had to confess that you were hurt. Tears had to be streaming down your face. And then, by God, you've got it. We've got you trained. And you take that and you carry that into the modern world. And all at once, we have psychological casualties. We have people who go on a weekend retreat and start doing this stuff in their church basements. And they don't know what they're doing. And it can cause, I mean, you get all these blessings out of this diversity training. Well, sometimes it causes a lot of psychological harm. And there have been many cases years ago where I would be asked to come into a company cleaning up the blood after one of these guys.
Because Amen.
And there would be blood all over the floor, and I would go in and say, no. You don't have to confess. You don't have to beat up. You don't have to get all emotive. And that's the beauty of what we're talking about today, because when we start putting it in terms of culture, we're saying, isn't it interesting that Kojo looks at it this way, I look at it this way, because of our different background? I'm not saying you're bad or good. I'm just saying, isn't it interesting? So we can talk about very sensitive things, such as gender and race, without it becoming emotional, without screaming at each other. And that's where the real understanding comes about, in my opinion.
Got to take a short break. There are several callers on the line who'd like to join this conversation. If you would like to join it, too, the number is 800-433-8850. Have you ever committed a cultural faux pas when you've traveled abroad? You can also send email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WAMU 88.5. I'm Jessica Jordan. It's 1:23. Stay with us. There's more to come starting next hour with Tell Me More. That's at 2 o'clock. We'll hear about why some nonprofits are tax exempt. Plus, MasterChef Christine Ha talks about her new cookbook. That's all coming up on Tell Me More at 2 o'clock.
I'm investigative reporter Patrick Madden. From fire stations to former school buildings, the D.C. government has given away more than $200 million in taxpayer-owned properties to private developers.
It became very clear that there were ties between the developers who were receiving land subsidies and those who were even hosting fundraisers at their homes.
The city says it's good business. Critics call them sweetheart deals. Join us tomorrow during Morning Edition at 6:50 and 8:50 for the second story in our five-part investigative series, Deals for Developers.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Rubenstein Family Foundation and the Posse Foundation, a college access program that identifies young leaders from urban public high schools and sends them to colleges and universities. More at possefoundation.org. And from MedStar Health, committed to providing accessible health care across the region, near to where you live or work. More at medstarhealth.org/closetoyou. Or 866-9-MEDSTAR.
Now back to the Kojo Nnamdi Show.
Welcome back to our conversation on cultural competence. We're talking with Howard Ross. He's a diversity consultant and the principal of Cook Ross. And Gary Weaver is a professor at American University School of International Service. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. We move now to Tom in Springfield, Virginia. Tom, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. I think it's important to differentiate between cultural competence and cultural sensitivity. And if you're going into some specific culture, you can study up on it and maybe become a little competent. But in most of our interactions in a sort of a global environment, it's important just to be culturally sensitive and to admit that you do have a different perspective and to put that out up front and say, you know, you may view this differently. So if, you know, where you're coming from is different, please correct me if I need correcting, and sort of being open to the other person's experience rather than thinking you could be competent in everybody's culture.
That's true. You're saying that cultural competence may be a step farther. It requires some knowledge, some understanding, where cultural sensitivity really means just being sensitive to the fact that you're not in your own or a culture that is familiar to you. A lot of us working now in offices where we're undertaking projects with or talking regularly with colleagues who are overseas, what kinds of challenges are most common when you're trying to work productively with colleagues in different cultures who you may only see on video screens, Howard?
Well, I think, you know, look, you could take virtually any industry and show it. I mean, I was with a law firm in New York City the other day. I was talking to a bunch of litigators, and in the midst of a conversation, you know, I was talking with them about the voir dire process where they're interviewing jurors. And And I said to them, so, you know, what's that like? And they said, well, a lot of it is gut instinct and picking up certain signals. I said, so, for example, you know, what do you do if you've got somebody on the who you're interviewing during the process and they don't make eye contact with you? And to a one, every one of them said, don't want them on the jury. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. What if you find out they come from a culture in which averting their eyes is a sign of respect, but making direct eye contact is a sign of insolence? And they said, oh, you know. So you said that we talked about healthcare already. Of course, in the military, hundreds of examples of times when for example, in Iraq, when soldiers thought that they were telling people to stop with a hand signal that was actually telling them to come forward, and people almost getting shot. Gary, I know you've probably got hundreds of examples of the same.
If I can just add to what you're saying, we had the incident up in Boston with the marathon runners. And if you recall, the young man appeared before a judge, a female judge, who thought that he was insolent because he kept looking down at the floor. Remember that?
Yes.
And that was the lead story in all the newspapers. This kid was defiant to this judge, whereas in Eastern Europe, that's how you show respect to somebody of higher status. But of all the hundreds of reporters that reported on this, not one said, wait a minute, maybe it's just culturally different.
Indeed, we got an email from Lori who says, thank you for talking about this important topic. I teach biotechnology at Montgomery College, and many of our students are from other cultures. When talking about applying and interviewing for jobs, we mention American business expectations, specifically one, eye contact. Americans make eye contact regardless of age or title. Two, the handshake. And three, personal space. Americans have a large personal space. Cultural misunderstandings, such as not making eye contact, can be misinterpreted as extreme shyness rather than the show of respect it is in other cultures, a point that both of you were just making.
Yeah, or for that matter, firmness of handshake, which we, you know, in American, you know, in our norm, handshakes are like wrestling matches.
Yes,
you know,
if you can't make somebody cry out in pain,
exactly,
it's not a genuine handshake.
And, of course, in many other cultures, that's considered aggressive. A softer handshake is much more welcoming. But I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, or when I ask, you know, in audiences I'm training, how many of you believe that if you shake hands with somebody at the beginning of an interview and they shake hands softly, it's already at the least a point against them, and maybe you don't even hire them for that reason? And it's astonishing how many people, you know, I mean, how idiotic is that to take one interactive point like that and turn it into an overall assessment of a candidate? But it's a good indication of sort of the way the mind works, how quickly we take those stereotypical behaviors and then justify them.
Gary, I mentioned video screens earlier. This kind of virtual work life is also happening in classrooms. At American University, you've just kicked off the International School's first class, where you meet with students located around the world in a video conference. What do you hope your students will learn from this experience, especially since they're not seeing the other person in person?
Well, I'm biased against online learning. I didn't believe in it because I'm an old-time lecturer, classroom, that sort of thing. But this new technology allows you to have each of your students on the screen. It's like the opening to the Brady Bunch. You know, you got them all there. And so you're making eye contact with them continually through the course. Actually, I have more interaction with students than I have in the classroom. In the classroom, if I'm talking to one student, I can't look at the others. Here I can see all of them at the same time. They can talk over each other. So it's not our image of online learning as a glorified chat room or some kind of a Skype thing. The technology has gone way beyond that. And the beauty of it in our area, intercultural relations, is my students come from all over the world. So I've got somebody in Afghanistan, a soldier, at 3 o'clock in the morning, somebody in Belgium at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and they're all over the world. But it's like we're sitting around a table having a cup of coffee together. So I'm beginning to overcome my bias. I'll still be resistant, but I'm beginning to appreciate how this technology can actually connect us rather than disconnect us.
Back to the telephones again. Here now is Diane in Laurel, Maryland. Diane, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'd just like to tell you briefly about my cultural misunderstanding in doing business here in the United States. I had a situation years ago where I was trying to purchase a mattress, and the guy was from, I don't know, out of the country someplace, and he had people of his culture that were there, and I was watching how the businesses were going on, and I assumed that I'd be getting the same deal, because in America, that's what we've been instilled. When you're doing business, everybody is treated the same, only I found out that that wasn't the deal. I ended up putting down a deposit and thought the next day I could come back and get my deposit. I couldn't. It ended up taking me a year, to get my deposit back and going through all these ridiculous escalations, long story short, his friend, when it got physical, his friend was the one who cleared the air and said, he will give you your money back. And he, through his intervention and consumer affairs, it was a learning lesson both for him and I, and that he was kind of sort of not to harm or anything, but he was what I call playing both sides. You're trying to do business for people of your culture like you always do and be fair to them, but at the same time, he wasn't doing that with people of his non-culture. And so it was kind of getting him in trouble. It was looking like he was misrepresenting himself. And it was all explained, and it was a lesson learned for him and for me, but it is not one I would want to go through again to teach anybody again.
Sounds like a fairly complicated situation that you found yourself in, Diane. I'm glad it was ultimately resolved to your satisfaction. Howard, I have read a statistic that around 80% of mergers and acquisitions fail to meet financial expectations. When businesses combine forces, it seems they often overlook the importance of meshing the cultures of
absolutely
those offices
and that,
as well.
That's a lot of the work that we've done over the years with businesses. You know, the organizational development work that we do is working in cultural and bringing those cultures together for exactly that reason. I can give you an example of the way this shows up in a very simple and somewhat humorous form. We were working bringing two companies together. They were in the utility industry, and one of them was a very structured environment, very buttoned down, sort of, you know, everything had rules and regulations and was followed to the letter by rules and regulations, which is actually more common in the utility industry because there's so many safety considerations. Obviously, people can die if people do things the wrong way in power plants and the like. And they were talking about a potential merger with a company that had a much more free-flowing kind of a cowboy culture where people, kind of thought on the moment and et cetera. And so we were having these meetings as we were getting together with the leaders of the two different, you know, for example, the two different IT or the two different HR groups or whatever. And one of the leaders of one of these teams who was from the looser culture sent out an invitation to this meeting said the agenda was 9 to 12, and we were going to be talking about such and such subjects. And the day before the meeting, he gets a phone message from his cohort on the other side who says, I received your invitation. Since there's no clear agenda here, I won't be attending the meeting. Because in their culture, the meetings would literally have said, and I mean this literally to the minute, 9 to 9:08 introductions of participants, 9:08 to 9:17. And so as far as he was concerned, 9 to 12 talking about this subject, this was too vague to be worthwhile in his world. So I mean, that's just an indication, but it shows up in many, many different ways in organizational cultures.
800-433-8850 is the number if you'd like to join this conversation on cultural competence or, for that matter, cultural sensitivity. Are you an immigrant to this country? What confuses you about the American culture? 800-433-8850. Gary, can you talk a little bit about the kinds of differences, maybe some examples, in work and decision-making across cultures and what happens?
Yeah, for example, in cultures that are traditionally non-Northern European, Asian, African, Latin American, often you have to develop a relationship before you can get down to business. And this getting acquainted phase is absolutely essential because it helps the other person to know your character, the type of person you are. Americans, if you're from Manhattan, you usually want to get right down to business. You don't want all the chit-chat and so forth. So the American comes across as if we're pushy. We don't want to develop a relationship. And on the other hand, the American is looking at the fellow from Mexico City and thinking, you're totally incompetent. I mean, what do you mean talking about my father? I mean, my father has nothing to do with this business deal. But if you don't respect your own father, why would you respect me? Mm-hmm. So the way you answer that question could have a tremendous impact on getting the business deal settled. So it's a completely different way of thinking, but it shapes the way you do business. It shapes your conversation and so forth. Even the way we identify ourselves, we meet somebody at a party and we say, hello, I'm Gary Weaver. I'm a professor at American University. What do you do? And the implication is if I'm not doing anything, I don't have an identity. To a certain extent, that's true.
Well, I'm pretty good at doing nothing myself.
You know, the same thing you're talking about, Gary, can exist in differences between New York City and Jackson, Mississippi as well.
Absolutely.
You
know,
I'm glad you brought that up. We have a caller who wants to address that. Here's Janet in Fairfax, Virginia. Janet, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Yes, that is exactly the subject I wanted to address. I worked for many years in the Washington, D.C. area as an auto damage appraiser, and most of our management was from northern, from New England and from New Jersey, and many of the people who were working were from the south. And we found large differences in the way we would approach people and the way we would speak to one another and so on. And one of the things that came up in meeting was a woman in management said, the first thing you do is you offer your hand. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't, especially if I'm speaking to a woman. I let her offer her hand first. And during the conversation, she did a quick tally of the people in the room, and everyone from the north felt it was appropriate to stick their hand out right away, and everyone from the south, particularly the men, said, no, absolutely not, especially when I'm speaking to a woman. And
here's Howard Roth.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Janet. I mean, I had just by the virtue of the way its schedule ended up, about 2 years ago, I was working with two of my clients, both law firms, one in Jackson, Mississippi, one in New York City, and I'm down in Jackson. I'm doing the same thing, interviewing some of the lawyers, right? So down in Jackson, it's typical to talk about the kids and the dogs for a while before you get to business. I mean, so you sit and you chat for about 10 minutes, and then you get to business along the lines of what Gary was saying. You get to know each other a little bit. So I'm doing that for a couple of days, and then I get on a plane. I fly up to New York City. I come in, and in New York City, of course, you're not even in your chair when people say, what are you here for? So it was culture shock to see it so dramatically within the 2 days. It's not like I don't know what happens, but there's sometimes when we're doing this work where it just hits you right flush in the face.
Just to add something to what I think Janet has said, part of it may be generational, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find that the younger generation tends to, how can I put this politely, the courtesies that you would have in a conversation might not be well developed. So I'll get a young person who'll come to my office and say about my grade, and I'll say, let's begin with good morning, how are you? I mean, a few pleasantries, and I'm realizing there are different generations, and we can talk about generational cultures
absolutely.
As well. Absolutely. So I'm used to opening the door for anybody, but particularly a woman. My younger female students wonder, what am I up to?
Yeah, well, and I think the very technology that you were talking about, Gary, impacts that too, because when you live in a world of texting, when communications are blip, 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 you know, really quick, or tweeting and things like this, you know, everything is concise, not even spelling out the whole world, and that becomes our way of communicating, and it translates very easily to how I'm communicating face-to-face, and so we do lose some of those, what we sometimes call the pleasantries, but they're actually the foundation for communication when we've created a connection, a relationship in terms of how we've been treating each other.
But you both raise an interesting question. Do we even know our own cultural norms? Is it something we think about consciously, or do we just notice it when someone transgresses?
Well, this is the interesting thing about us Americans, I think, is most of us Americans aren't really sure we have a culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you ask the average American on the street, what is the American culture? I mean, they would find that to be a strange question because we don't think about it. We don't talk about our culture. We're not like the stereotype of the French people who sit in cafes in Paris and discuss what it means to be French. I mean, we take our culture for granted. And when you were talking about training earlier, I think Howard has probably found this to be true. Very often with our clients, we have to begin with know thy own culture first. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you appreciate how someone else's culture has shaped their way of thinking, the way they communicate, if you don't realize that your culture has shaped the way you think, the way you communicate? So often you've got to stop people in their tracks and say, before we start studying people from Kenya, let's look at Americans and see what are some general characteristics of people here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, this is characteristically true of people who are in dominant cultural groups. And because we are now the dominant cultural group in the world, relative to how business is conducted, for example, and most people are generally accommodating to Americans' way of doing business, it makes us particularly blind to ourselves. You know, there's the classic old story of the older fish who swims past the other two fish and says, "How's the water?" And one fish turns to the other and says, "What's water?" I mean, we don't even realize that we're in it. You know, the same thing is true when we look at race issues in the United States. You know, white people don't necessarily think about themselves as having a culture. People of color absolutely see white culture. Men don't think of the masculine culture of work environments. Women absolutely see it. And this isn't because we're bad people. It's because that we don't have to look at those things. When the normative culture that we're in is the culture we were grown up in, it is the culture. It's not our culture. And when other people who we deal with are more likely to accommodate to that culture, that just reinforces that notion.
Jana, thank you very much for your call. Here is Frank in Fairfax, Virginia. Frank, your turn.
Thank you, gentlemen, for an interesting discussion. I'd like to raise it up a little bit to what I experienced coming from an earlier generation when we constantly borrowed from European culture in particular before the 60s. For example, I'm not a fan of the atom bomb, but we had four Hungarians and Niels Bohr from Denmark and other luminaries who assisted us in making the bomb and then the rocketry and so forth. But in the 60s, the curtain seemed to come down, and that was spearheaded, I noticed, even by our highest university circles. For example, Princeton and MIT abandoned all language requirements. We were, I guess, superior in economically and technologically in those days, and maybe we felt we could do it alone. So I'm perceiving that we're now hurting because we can't take advantage of
allow
other
me
cultures.
Allow me to have both Gary and Howard respond. Gary?
Well, certainly one of the lessons of 9/11 is that we can't withdraw from the world. The two oceans are not going to keep other people away from us. And furthermore, our economies are connected all over the world. And therefore, I think today we realize that we really are dependent upon other cultures. We can't go it alone. And it's very unlikely that any young person today will end up working only with people from his or her own cultural background. So I think today there's a greater understanding of the need for intercultural competence, not just cultural competence, but the ability to actually interact with people who are culturally different domestically and internationally.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that I agree with that right on, and I also think that there's something underneath what Frank's saying about this change. And if we look at this historical change, if we look back to the times before, say, the 1960s, 1950s, when we've had heavy immigration into this country, it was overwhelmingly European. You know, at the turn of the last century, when my grandparents came, for example, 65% of immigrants came from Europe. Now, less than 30% do. And that means more different cultures, but also more different in appearance, blacker, browner, you know, other people of color from all around the world. And it brings up a greater sense of xenophobia, a greater sense of the other, people looking more different, acting more differently, and it's no surprise that we're having an increase again in the anti-immigrant feeling as a result of that, as the immigrant population comes in and looks more different.
Frank, thank you very much for your call. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation on cultural competence and cultural sensitivity, and take your calls at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. What tops your list of worst diplomatic blunders ever? You can also send us a tweet at Kojo Show. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Good afternoon. It's 1:43. You're listening to WAMU 88.5. Take a look at our website, WAMU.org. We're featuring a searchable database that will let you research the correlations between campaign contributions to elected D.C. officials and subsidies granted by city officials to developments. There's also a visual interactive along with expanded stories that explain the connections. Explore the data, read the stories, and let us know of any interesting connections that you were able to spot. Send your thoughts to dcproject@wamu.org.
The D.C. Jazz Festival and Events D.C. present Jazz in the Hoods. Highlighting D.C. as a vibrant cultural center, Jazz in the Hoods features more than 80 performances in neighborhoods throughout the city. WAMU 88.5 is proud to be a media sponsor for the D.C. Jazz Festival's Jazz in the Hoods, June 5th through June 16th. More information is at WAMU.org under events. Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Wells Fargo, working with the Washington Area Community Investment Fund to provide small business training. Details on this work in the community are at wellsfargo.com/commitment. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And from Physical and Massage Therapy Associates, committed to providing holistic one-on-one treatment for your healthcare needs. Physical therapists offering a personalized approach. 202-966-2033.
It's now 75 degrees in Northwest D.C. Let's get back to the Kodjo Namdi Show.
Welcome back to our conversation on cultural competence with Gary Weaver. He's a professor at American University School of International Service and executive director of the university's Intercultural Management Institute. Howard Ross is diversity consultant and principal of Cook Ross and author of Reinventing Diversity, Transforming Organizational Community to Strengthen People, Purpose, and Performance. If you'd like to join the conversation, you should probably shoot us an email to kojo@wamu.org. Here's Raphael in McLean, Virginia. Raphael, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kodjo. Glad to be here. Thanks. Listen, I just want to talk about my experience with the FUPA in Latin America. I'm from Puerto Rico. I went to University of Puerto Rico, but the language I took there was German. So I spoke Spanish and English since I was born. But I was translating one time for the chief of staff of the army in Argentina. And I used a common word that we use in the Caribbean, which is coger, to take. And after I used it about five or six times, one of the officers from Argentina came up to me and said, you know, we don't use that word here. It has sexual connotations. I was in Special Forces. I had spent almost 15 years in Latin America. So I said, he's pulling my chain. Mm-hmm. And when I talked to a couple of the people, said, no, that's a bad word here. You shouldn't use it.
Which is an indication of the distinction that has to be made between language and culture. Yeah. Because we often feel that if we know the language, then we know the culture. But that same language in another culture has different meanings for words and different implications of words.
Well, and even more than that, it actually, the language shapes the way we think. We were just talking about how there's a professor, Lara Boroditsky, who's at Stanford University now, who studies neurolinguistics. And what she's starting to find is that because we can now watch the brain working in different ways, that you can see that the brain actually functions differently depending upon the particular language that we have. So certain cultures, you know, if you look at the German language, for example, it doesn't have the language of subtlety in it that other languages do. It's a much more direct language by its nature. You have to work hard to find, I mean, I don't speak German, but one of my best friends is German. We've talked a lot about this, that it requires you to shape very carefully what you're saying to bring in subtlety, because it's not built into the language. The language is very much straightforward.
Well, Raphael speaks German, so Raphael, you can probably underscore what Howard just said.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know what? Well, my experience after that was, before I traveled to any other country, I went to Mexico, all of Central America, I used to ask some of the locals, people, give me a list of all the words that I should not use. And I'm talking of common words that you and I would use, you know, in Spanish I'm talking about now, mm-hmm. that we would use daily, and they were saying, no, you can't use that word here. That's, you know, and I'm going, so I had, for each country, I had literally, you know, three or four pages of bad words.
I hear you. Thank you very much for your call. Kim in Clinton, Maryland, has something that we may have talked about in the break. Kim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I was at UCSD, and we were in the pediatric clinic when a Hmong, who's one of the boat people who came over to California in the 70s and 80s, came in with two kids. The little one had a upper respiratory nothing, but the older one was showing signs of a bad diphtheria, and we freaked out, isolated the older child. The mother, who spoke very limited English, was really upset because we obviously did not know what we were doing. We took the wrong kid. The pediatrician was trying to pat her on the back and explain it's okay, and patted the little one on his head. It turns out in the Hmong culture it is a complete insult to a touch above the shoulders. It became a huge incident, and it ended up with the university had to donate a chicken And there had to be a sacrifice on the roof of the university hospital in order by the priest of Hmong culture to get rid of the curse and allow the family to be reunited.
Indeed, we were talking about that patting on the head during the course of the break, Kim, and why that in some cultures is considered disrespectful and offensive. But Gary, she also mentioned that the mother did not speak English very well. Are there some rules of thumb we should keep in mind when we speak with colleagues, acquaintances who don't speak English fluently?
Well, I think if possible, you need to find somebody who can speak the local language. I mean, because as Howard just said, it's not just a matter of language, it's a matter of a whole different way of thinking. But sometimes it's not possible. And you can rely upon nonverbal communications, gestures, and so forth. And that can be very helpful. But those are the kinds of things where the greatest misunderstanding occurs. As you said, President Clinton going to Bangkok after the tsunami couldn't resist himself and kept patting Thais on the head. Well, it's fairly innocent, but it made the front pages of every newspaper in Bangkok because, as this lady said, it's a tremendous insult. So having somebody, an informant, a local person who can tell you these things, verbal and nonverbal, is very useful. The problem is, very often, local people don't even think about this. They just do it naturally.
Right, and I think that you know, Kim Sturpies, there's also just there's a wonderful book, which unfortunately the name escapes me. It's when about the Hmong culture and healthcare, mm-hmm. and I wish I could recall it right now. I just can't. But it's very important for us to recognize that healthcare is one of the areas that this is most critical for a number of reasons. First of all, because we're dealing with life and death situations, and the subtlety of getting the right information at the right time is critical at that moment. You often don't have a second chance to do that. Secondly, because even if people are very literate in terms of their ability to function on a day-to-day basis, they may not be health literate. And when you start talking about, you know, colonoscopy or something like that in another language, it's very different than saying, you know, where do you go to the bathroom? And thirdly, because often when we're interacting with people in healthcare environments, and you know, whether it's a doctor or a nurse or whoever, people are traumatized. They're dealing with something that's very frightening. They're either sick or a family member or somebody who they love is sick, and therefore the heightened sense of urgency about it can make us return even more to our native cultures. You know, our culture of origin often is where we go when we're the most frightened, when we're the most scared, and at times like that, so you have a combination of the criticality of the situation and the tendency to people to revert to their basic cultures even more is just it's a nexus of a perfect storm potential.
If I can just add a quick sentence here, Howard, you're absolutely correct. In a crisis situation, people go to their rule of thumb, mm-hmm. which means my native culture. It That's also right. means prejudice. And in law enforcement, this is very common. I mean, at the very point when the police officer should step back and say, I wonder what the cultural aspects are, that's the last time you do it. So one person's, I'm very sincere, which is why I'm getting loud and I'm waving my hands, is another person's, you're out of control, call security.
Well,
I mean, how do you know?
Speaking of police officers, I think that's what Alan in Washington, D.C. wants to talk about. Alan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi there. I was just remembering once a while back on Mount Pleasant, a largely Hispanic neighborhood now in Washington, D.C., This white police officer and his Hispanic rookie, they pulled over this Hispanic man walking home late at night and threw him against the car and had his hands down on the car. And the white cop asked him a question. So the Hispanic guy, he raised his hands and he's talking, you know, gesticulating as he's talking. The cop threw him back down on the car, spread his legs, slapped him down on the car, asked him the same question again. Again, he tries to raise his hands to talk. And again, the cop was the second time splattering him on the car hood. The Hispanic rookie then humbly steps in and just whispers to the guy real quick, look, you got to answer without your hands. The white cop was oblivious, had no idea of the cultural difference there. A lot of cultures, you cannot talk without your hands. There's a link that does not allow you otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And it's instinctive. It's important for us to realize, Alan, that when things like that happen, it's not like people think about, I'm going to use my hands now to talk. The mouth starts and the hands start at the same time. It's a built-in instinct.
Thank you very much for your call, Alan. We got an email that says, I just wanted to comment that cultural etiquette is becoming even more confusing for first-generation Americans like myself, who are raised in their traditional cultural norms at home and then go to school and are taught a completely different set of them. We often operate within both and have to relearn what the American cultural etiquette norm is. Do your speakers have any experience encountering this?
Yeah, this is a phenomenon that in research we used to call being a third culture kid. It applies to the immigrant child. You're not part of your parents' culture or the new culture. You're in between cultures, and usually you end up being somewhat bicultural, and you have to go back and forth between the two cultures, which other kids don't have to do. So you tend to generate relationships with other third culture kids because you're sharing a common phenomenon. This is becoming increasingly more common with the new immigrants coming into this country.
Yeah, and of course our president is now somebody who's a third culture kid, and one of the things that happens when you're raised in a TCK situation is that it's not just that you learn about the different cultures that you happen to be a part of, if you're an American growing up in Korea, for example, or something like that, but you also develop an inherent sense of relativism about culture that people who grow up in one culture don't. So yourself, Kojo, you know, for example, you growing up in another culture and coming to this country, you've lived in two different cultures, so you know that cultures are different and that both can potentially have values and both can potentially have negative sides to them. And so when one encounters a new culture coming from that experience, the natural tendency is to be more relative rather than definitive in terms of how we see a different culture.
Sometimes you ask a third culture kid, who are you? And he says, when?
We got an email from Chuck in Brentwood who said, much of the anxiety over cultural competency comes from the fear that we will inadvertently offend people. And the examples you've given of cultural gaffes feeds that. I've traveled a lot in East Asia, and I find that this is not something to worry too much about. The people I deal with are usually pretty cosmopolitan themselves, lucky you. They understand that I'm a foreigner and not likely to completely understand all their norms for interaction, and they cut me a fair amount of slack. The real trick is to be open to new experiences, be open to learning, try to pick up some of the language if you can to show you want to meet them halfway. Things will go generally pretty well.
Well, and that's one of the reasons when I'm working with people who I know are going to be working with another culture, and that means either domestically or internationally, one of the things I make sure to tell them is, look, in addition to all the things you try to learn around that culture, make sure you learn the culturally appropriate way to say, I'm sorry. That I made an inadvertent mistake and I apologize. We're going to make mistakes. We'll never be perfect. We can't remember all this. So learning how to responsibly say I'm sorry is a very important part of the process.
Howard Ross, he's a diversity consultant and principal of Cook Ross, author of the book Reinventing Diversity, Transforming Organizational Community to Strengthen People, Purpose, and Performance. Howard, thank you for joining.
Thanks so much, Kojo. Good to see you.
Gary Weaver is professor at American University School of International Service. He's also executive director of the university's Intercultural Management Institute. Gary, thank you for joining
us. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nnamdi Show, Free Speech and the Web. Tech Tuesday explores how U.S. internet companies navigate different laws and norms across the globe. Then at 1, as the Obama administration cracks down on whistleblowers, former high-level official Thomas Drake on the price he paid for exposing issues at the National Security Agency. The Kojo Nnamdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
At the ATF National Tracing Center, they trace guns used in crime, and that can mean lots of manual labor, hand searching, boxes of records.
The idea that